Welcome to a very special episode of the Experience Darden and Exec MBA podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty. And you may have noticed in the past week or so, we paused the podcast and we did that because we wanted to take a second and really get organized so that our next episodes really responded to everything going on in the world. In the wake of the killing of George Floyd and the protests across the nation, we wanted to provide content that was not only useful and helpful to those folks listening to this podcast, interested in learning more about our community, but also was topical and relevant. So we think we've done that. Hopefully you'll agree. Today, I'm excited to share my recent conversation with Darden professor Laura Morgan Roberts. We invited Laura on to talk about a recent conversation she had in her class, leading teams with some of our executive MBA students, but also generally, how do you create the space for students to have meaningful dialogue around race, equity, and inclusion in higher education? I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here is my interview with Laura Morgan Roberts. Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Brett.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time. We are connected on LinkedIn, and I've been following all the things that you've been posting and doing. I think you were most recently on a Harvard Business Review webinar. Is that right? Was that the last thing
I was on LinkedIn Live. I'm not sure if that was the last one sequentially. Let's just say last week, a lot of people started talking about race, which is a wonderful thing, and I'm happy to be a conversation partner. But the HBS LinkedIn Live webinar had a global audience, and because of that, I think there was a moment when people around the world just came with a genuine level of curiosity and added their own insight and perspective on these issues. And I know that sent messages to organizational leaders far and wide about the importance of having sustained conversations that lead to deeper understanding about race.
Well, I appreciate your making time for the podcast. We're going to talk about those same issues here today. And again, know how busy you've been. So really appreciate you carving out some time for us and for our listeners. We've been starting all these podcasts, at least recently, with the same first question. So before we get deeper into the conversation, I wanted to start by asking, you know, how are you and your family doing right now?
Oh, I would say that right now we are feeling a whole range of emotions. In the past few months, it's been a roller coaster of emotions. There's been the unpredictable wave of uncertainty around COVID-19 and working from home and learning from home and, you know, having to do extreme pivots around that while not having a full understanding of the scope or the impact of the virus. There was a range of emotions around concern and grief on the loss of life due to COVID-19. And then layered onto that, just the full acknowledgement in our homes, on the streets, in our cities and neighborhoods all around the world of the loss of life and the lack of safety, physical safety that so many African American families feel when they're just trying to make it through the day-to-day challenges and struggles of life, much less trying to sort of walk and breathe and live through a global pandemic. So that's really been a wave of emotions. And I think in response, there's also at times a feeling of exhilaration, like, okay, we're riding the wave. Like, we're doing this. We figured this out. We're conquering some of these things. So we're having to practice the agility to develop the kinds of routines that work most for us. And, you know, I can recall trying to teach agility to some of my MBA students at Georgetown McDonough a few years ago. And it was a challenging conversation because there's an analytical piece of thinking about agility and living in unpredictable and uncertain terms of crisis. And then there's just having to live it day in and day out. And so I think that's where we are now, is living it day in and day out. Because the last emotion that I have that adds to the layers is around the current degree of attention, concern for some, just like righteous outrage about what's been happening in our world and what's been happening so long in our world around inequality and injustice, particularly as it relates to race, but also and when we're thinking about how our economies have functioned and how our health systems function as well. And so, you know, there's a glimmer of hope in there too, that, wow, you know, we're finally sort of having this conversation, and maybe that means that we can listen and learn. And, you know, for me, I'm hoping that we can develop some more robust and sustainable solutions to these longstanding problems, you know, and that'll get us into a better place, so we don't feel like we're watching an endless reel of loss and anxiety, and instead that we're seeing justice and progress that's reflected in our communities and in our institutions.
It does feel at this particular moment like a lot of different things have come to a head, and that we collectively, as a country, as a society, have an opportunity to engage with them, whether it's issues around social justice, racial equity, also inclusion, the sort of economics of how our society functions right now, labor and labor disruption. I mean, there are so many things that are happening, access to healthcare, sort of what health looks like in our country and how that breaks down along socioeconomic and racial lines. There are, in the past 2 to 3 months, it feels like there have been so many things percolating. But as you note, these conversations create opportunities, or at least that's what I have been thinking. It sounds like that resonates with you.
Definitely.
Well, tell us more about your story and your background. You know, where are you from? How did you get into higher education? Did you imagine you would be a professor? I have so many questions for you.
Well, I come from a family of a long line of higher ed enthusiasts. So I grew up in Gary, Indiana, which is also my father's hometown. My mother grew up in Washington, D.C. So we have lineage from Washington, D.C. as well, which is where I'm currently based. And my mother's grandmother was born in Charlottesville, where some of her ancestors were actually cooks at the University of Virginia. When I was graduating from high school in Indiana, I was trying to find a school that would have the right mix of fun and academic excellence, and in a location that I was excited about spending the next 4 years. And so I found my way to Charlottesville. And so from 92 to 96, I was an undergrad at UVA, a psychology major, but I flirted with the comm school. Since I was an Eccles scholar, that meant that I didn't have to declare a major. And so I wanted to give myself a little bit, to take advantage of that freedom intellectually. And so I ultimately declared a major in psychology instead of going into the comm school. But meanwhile, I got to sample classes about leadership and organizations from all over the university in different disciplines, which was really cool for me. And then with my senior honors thesis, one of my advisors was an expert in the area of social identity and race and leadership. Her name is Robin Johnson. She's now in California at UCLA. But I took that bus over to North Grounds and found my way to her office a few times. And that was really the first time I set foot on Darden's grounds. I went away to a gifted and talented residential academy on the campus of Ball State University when I was 15 years old. And we lived in a dorm, and I've basically been on college campuses or in higher education ever since. So did I want to be a professor from a very early age? Yes, I did. You know, right after I decided that I might get bored being a DJ, I like the idea of being a translator, but ultimately, and I think I still am kind of a translator, but ultimately I wanted to help people have a more fulfilling experience in their work, knowing the central role that work played in people's lives. With respect to race, my experiences growing up in Gary were very central to my identity and my development. So I grew up understanding race and racism as a structural property of differential access to resources and opportunities. So it wasn't about being the only in my class or never seeing Black teachers or principals or physicians or lawyers. I saw all of those examples of Black excellence on a regular basis. And I was inculcated with that, but I was also quite mindful of the disparities between what our Black communities in Gary had to offer and what we had access to, that is, in terms of commercial growth and vitality and a solid economic base in the surrounding communities versus dwindling economic base and the kind of continuing exodus of commercial and career opportunities from Gary throughout my childhood. So I wanted to always take into account that context in the work that I do around leadership and organizations. It was just a part of my reality, and therefore I wanted it to be a part of my my life's work as well. And I'm thankful that it has been.
So for our listeners who are learning about you, tell us what courses you teach at Darden.
At Darden, I teach primarily in EMBA. I also teach some executive ed courses. But within EMBA, I teach negotiations electives. I teach an elective on leading teams. I've taught an elective on talent management. In the coming year, I'll be offering a new elective on managing diversity and leveraging differences. That elective has been offered for several years in the residential program, and so now we're bringing that into the EMBA suite as well. So we're excited about that, and I'm helping to plan and facilitate LR1, which is the opening leadership residency in the EMBA program.
So you're very busy, in other
words.
I'm
a leadership person, basically.
That's right.
I'm a leadership person.
Right. So I want to talk. So I think at the Darden School right now, there's been several updates over the past week about, you know, the school, you know, actively working to make racial equity, inclusion, diversity, more forward in the life of the school, more present in day-to-day and in classroom. Although I think we all acknowledge that this is very much a work in progress, and students are certainly, you know, helping us think about this, faculty and staff as well, about how we can continue to move forward as a community. I wanted to take some time here on the podcast talk with you about our recent weekend residency, which, you know, in the executive MBA program took place while there were protests going on across the country in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. And just what I heard as someone who wasn't there for the weekend residency, but what I heard is in your leading teams class, you had made space for conversations about what was taking place that weekend. How did that conversation come about? Was it something that you came into the weekend, or at least as you prepared for class that day, you knew you were going to talk about, or did it develop another way?
Well, I think it was a combination of both. So I had segments during the residency on Friday afternoon and on Saturday morning. Now, Thursday night, one of the students, the EMBA students, wrote a letter and just spoke from his heart about how he was experiencing everything that was happening as an African American male, and invited us as a community into deeper consideration and deeper dialogue in the time that we had together over the weekend. And so, and that student happened to be taking my elective. So at that point, I knew that I had to do justice to his courage and his bravery in that moment to just communicate to his colleagues, this hurts. I'm hurting. We're hurting. This is a trying time. How can we learn from each other and support each other? That takes courage. I mean, there have been a series of blog posts and formal announcements, even by Black leaders who led diversity initiatives all over the country, using social media channels or their own platforms to send out a message to America and to our friends all around the world that said, look, we're tired. This fight for racial justice has been going on and on. We keep seeing these acts of police brutality. We keep seeing these acts of civil un you know just civil disruption and devaluation and demeaning Black people, and now it's being recorded, and these videos are being blasted all over social media, and we aren't seeing change, and we're tired. This was the collective voice. We're tired of not seeing change. When are we going to start doing things differently? And when are my colleagues going to pick up the mantle to try to advance this work? And so that was really the thread or the mindset, the tenor of the community, the various communities that were being impacted as we came into the weekend of our residency. And I was very attuned to that. This is my area of research and also just my personal lived experience and passion. I'm just very attuned. Wake up every morning and I read, what's in the news as relevant to conversations about race and justice and the public and political well-being of our world. And so, none of this was news to me. So yeah, it was queued up, it was teed up. But when a student said, can we create the space? Then I felt that that gave me the green light as a faculty member to hold space within the classroom. Because it's always a delicate balance around these issues, especially when social issues are concerned. You don't want to feel that you're making a huge shift in the moment where you're not addressing the material on the syllabus that you said you would cover and that the students, would be evaluated on, right? But you also don't want to come across as tone deaf, as if you're just marching through the curriculum business as usual and acting as though these pandemics of coronavirus and racism and everything else are not sort of ongoing and affecting the lives. People don't show up in a learning environment as a robot. They show up in learning environments as whole people. And so all of the different dimensions that are happening in their families and in their communities, that's all shaping their experiences as learners, especially EMBA, because they are continuing to work. So they're engaging in their leadership roles and responsibilities while being fully committed to their studies as a member of the Darden community. So it's always important that we are speaking to them in a holistic way so that they feel that the insight that they're gaining is will be helpful to them for the long run, but they also want tools and tips that will equip them to be better leaders right now in the moment. So I felt that urgency on many different levels. And we had some conversation that was connected to the content of the course, the Leading Teams course on Friday. We had already scheduled to feature Taryn Swan, who was our case protagonist when we covered the Nickelodeon at Latin America case. Taryn Swan is an African-American woman, and she was the general manager that launched the Nickelodeon Latin America Ventures. And so we talked about how she had built teams, and the conversation was really about the process of building a strong team. Well, then when she came in for a fireside chat style follow-up, we were also able to ask questions about the influences of race and gender and other dimensions of her leadership choices, you know, behind the scenes, so to speak. And so students saw a leader who was regarded as very effective and who was well respected, right? And so there weren't questions about her competence. They had already given her the thumbs up in terms of her leadership evaluation when we discussed the case. And I think when she came back and told some of her stories of what it was like to be a Black woman executive, that people doubted her ability and she had to confront racism at different points in her careers, it sort of encouraged people to listen differently than perhaps they often do, or perhaps we often do when we're having these conversations. So that was really important, having Taryn come in and fill the space. And we talked a bit on Friday. So I didn't know how to start the class. And I said, oh man, you know, I don't want to just jump in with the case discussion. That just would feel so abrupt. But I already had designated an opening block for a team building activity, something experiential, because the course is Leading Teams. So I offered them an arts-based team activity. And so their challenge was they had to come together and write a lyrical expression. So it could be a poem or a spoken word or song lyrics. And they had a short period of time, and I gave them a process for doing it so that everybody's voice was included in what they created. But through that process, they had some space to put voice and words to their feelings. The theme was psychological safety anyway, right? So it just completely aligned with where we needed to be. But they didn't have to be so deeply analytical right out the gate. They could just pause and talk about what it feels like to be safe or unsafe. And that helped to build trust. So by the time we came together on Saturday, they were going to have a fair amount of time to work on their final group projects. But here's where I made the pivot. This is where that agility comes in. I had watched the news. I start the night before, and I started out by saying, wow, this is really heavy. I watched the news, and it's just difficult to see and feel all that's happening right now. And other students started opening up. There were tears. And people just talked about how painful and scary it all was. And I knew that was the moment for us to just stay right there. And so we did. As a group, we calmly and patiently stayed there. And we listened to one another's voices. And some people were slow to speak, but their classmates encouraged them to speak and helped them to understand how and why their voice mattered in the space as well. And so it ended up being one of those moments that you hope and pray for as a faculty member, where people walk away at the end of class saying, I learned something. That's really all we're going for here. I know oftentimes you think like faculty life becomes about entertainment value or a popularity contest and all of that. But not for me. For me, it's just the hope and dream that when people walk away from a session, they say they learned something. Not just, oh, that was an interesting fact, but like I learned something that I think will change the way that I approach my leadership and my collaborations going forward. And we were able to share that. It was powerful.
I can imagine so. So much there that you shared resonates. I think about your role in that class and the conversation of sort of leading teams about how what you're doing in that class often parallels what perhaps students are thinking about doing at their own organizations, right? Having these conversations, how do you make space? How do you create the opportunity for someone to bring their whole self with them to work and to engage in meaningful conversation? Do you think about that parallelism?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, several of them were able to engage in those conversations in their workspaces and also in their families, you know, after the discussion that we had had in the classroom. And so that was really important. We're trying to plant seeds, if I would put it as humbly as possible. You know, higher ed is always an ambitious venture, right? But you really only see the impact of what happens within your higher ed experience when things are nurtured and they grow over time. And then it starts to change practices which can transform society. But, you know, the most we can do in a classroom environment is to plant some seeds and give folks some more to work with as they carry forward. And because of that, the modeling is so important. And by and large, in business school classrooms, race is unspeakable. It remains in the hush box. People don't really want to touch it with a 10-foot pole because they're worried that it's going to blow up. People of color are worried that one of their classmates is going to say something that will be hard to forget or hard to unhear, and, you know, may therefore damage the relationship. White people are afraid that they may say something that will be interpreted as discriminatory, biased, or racist, and call into question their worth and virtue as a human being. And so faculty are scared that the conversation starts, things go sideways, and then they'll get blamed for not handling it the right way, or, you know, not responding to something that one person said that another person felt was deeply offensive. So it just takes a lot of trust.
Well, I'm so interested as a faculty member about how you help build that trust. How do you help create an environment where it is possible? And maybe this is an institutional question. Maybe it's not just a classroom question. Maybe it's a school question too. But how do you help get your students to a place where they feel like, all right, this is something that, you know, I think you could probably say that race is one of those things we don't talk about here in the US really at all. Do we avoid this conversation beyond just business school? So how do you help your students get to a place where they can actually have this conversation?
Well, a lot of it is timing. At Darden, for instance, because we use the case method, that pedagogy allows the student voice to co-create the agenda for the classroom. It's not just the faculty comes in with their fully scripted lecture notes and the students have to sit there as receptacles and take in whatever the faculty prepared to discuss on that day. And they can ask questions of the faculty if they want. You know, that's not how the learning experience takes place in a classroom like Darden. It's all about inviting people to engage, to consider, to weigh the pros and cons of different choices, a range of possible choices, and to anticipate the consequences of the decisions that they will make and be ready to account, even in a classroom environment, be ready to account for whatever decision or choice they are recommending. So, you know, in that respect, I listen for the signals that students want to talk about race or want to talk about gender. They'll make a comment, they'll ask a question in a case discussion, and I'll say, huh, yeah, that is an interesting question. Okay, so let's stay there for a minute. Or I might be a little playful and I say, oh, okay, so we're going there, huh? All right, well, let's do this. And people will sort of laugh and breathe a sigh of relief a little bit. That's often like with the gender conversation. You can be a little more playful with gender conversations sometimes because of the ways in which they come up. Race conversations tend to be a bit more serious and somber. But nevertheless, I try to be very respectful of the students who want to initiate conversations about race and other dimensions of difference in the classroom, and consider it my responsibility to let their questions stand, to invite responses to their question, to make sure that people don't just brush past their question and circle back to whatever we may have been talking about before and act like their classmate never said or mentioned anything about race at all. And that's what traditionally happens. You just kind of brush on by like it never happened. And then the student is sitting there, you know, feeling the angst of having attempted to initiate this conversation. I'll also say that, you know, one of the things that helps me as a faculty is getting feedback from students, trying to understand the pulse of the group. The pulse of the group is often leaning toward a desire to have deeper engagement around race. Now, there will be some loud voices who say, this is irrelevant. I didn't come to whatever school, business school, wherever, to talk about this. I didn't sign up for a program in African American studies. I signed up for a MBA and I want us to talk about finance, and we should be talking about finance, right? I mean, there are going to be those people who don't think that it's relevant to their personal experience and quite honestly can't see how it connects to the curriculum either. But, you know, here's the point of departure. We have to acknowledge that those voices don't often represent wider pulse of the group. The group often has a much greater openness and interest in having such conversations. And how do I know? Because afterwards, when I do hold the space for those conversations, students will come up to me afterwards and say, thank you for that. We really needed that. But you know what else I hear? This was one of the first times or the only times that we've had conversations like that in the course of my blank, blank, blank program. You know, so they're acknowledging that they have this desire to do it, but that their opportunities to engage in that way are few and far between. And I think part of that is because the voices of those who don't see it as being relevant or significant, they can derail the conversation. Because what do they say? The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
I think that's and, the expression.
Right? And the other folks who are curious but cautious, they don't want to kind of rock the boat. They don't want to be disruptive. They're just trying to go along to be team players, to be good cohort mates and so forth. You know, they may not be as outspoken about their interests and desire, but it doesn't mean it's not there. So that helps. I mean, also it helps a lot that I researched this, Brett, and I draw upon my research constantly. This is not for me about, you know, creating a space for therapy. I'm not a licensed therapist, though I give good advice. That's what I always tell people. Yes, I'm an organizational psychologist. I am not a licensed therapist, but I do give very good advice. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt, though. That's where we are. But I do research race and identity in organizations, talent management and leadership development. And I've been doing so for quite a while, and it helps to anchor the conversation in research. So you can tell people, no, this is not just in your head, and this is not just someone's opinion, you know, or self-interested plea or opinion, but what they are speaking to right now aligns with a pattern of behavior or interactions that or practices that we have observed in these contexts through research. And I try to bring in those references when I can, to help people to get a broader perspective on what's going on. I don't think anyone should leave a graduate program in business without having a facility toward learning across differences and having difficult conversations. Like, we would never let someone leave a business school program successively if they completely flunked finance. Like, oh, I'm just going to opt out because it's not really my thing. No. We said this is essential. It's a core competency. And if you finish our program, then you must demonstrate that you have this core competency because you're carrying our brand for it. And everybody who finishes our program has it. Likewise, with building a measure of cross-cultural competency, interpersonal, intergroup sensitivity, ability to have difficult, challenging conversations, and a more sophisticated understanding of how race, gender, class create opportunity structures and barriers for organizations.
That is an incredible point. When you put it that way, it particularly when you think about what an MBA really is about, particularly here at the Darden School General Management Program, that it is focused on growing students as leaders. I can think of no more important competencies than the ones you just articulated. I do want to talk about your research. You'd mentioned how your research informs your teaching and how you approach these conversations in the classroom. You published a book not so long ago, Race, Work, and Leadership, New Perspectives on the Black Experience. What was the process of putting this book together like? I always wonder that when people put out these publications, how much time and effort went into it? How did you get the idea to begin with?
There was a lot. There was a lot of time and energy that was put into developing this volume. But most specifically, I was working with Harvard Business School as a researcher and taking a deep dive to understand the history of race and the Black experience at Harvard Business School and to explore the career trajectories of HBS Black alumni. And so that was about a 3-year project. And in part of that, we also wanted to catalyze more research on the intersections of race, work, and leadership in ways that centered the Black experience. So we really curious in understanding what we could learn from the Black experience about race and about the workplace as a whole. So we decided to pursue an edited volume because we wanted to bring as many voices into the conversation as we could while we had the opportunity and the platform to disseminate this research. Destin, the ways that we talked about race remaining silent in the classroom and in boardrooms, it also remains silent in the ivory tower, where many researchers are advised not to pursue programs of research on race. Don't write about Black people, or no, we can't publish that study because it's not generalizable, because you don't have a comparison sample of white professionals. So how do you know anything? How are you learning anything by just studying Black professionals? And these researchers are saying, well, we've got a million studies that don't include Black professionals at all, but we don't question the validity or the generalizability of those studies. So it's an ongoing struggle for researchers who do the work because they want to positively affect change and they want to disseminate the findings more broadly, but they face a number of challenges in doing so. So we saw this huge win-win opportunity in developing the volume. It helped us to catalyze more research and to provide some tangible and provocative insights about how organizations today are operating and the extent to which they truly are inclusive, critically reflect on whether or not the initiatives to promote inclusion are actually working. But then we also were able to, I hope, provide more opportunities that amplify the voices of the scholars who conducted the research in our book. Some are senior scholars, but some are more junior scholars, but most of them have such powerful insights to share that we were grateful that they had contributed their work to our edited volume and that we had the honor and privilege of sharing their work with people all around the world. The book has been gaining a lot of interest, especially over the past week. And I'm thrilled because these are scholars who have been conducting this work for 20 years or more. And so it's as if an audience has now tuned in to a radio channel, an XM radio channel that had been playing 24/7, but only a small segment of listeners were tuned into it. And now a broader audience is tuning into that channel. But we don't have to develop the programming for that channel from scratch. This is programming that has been developed and curated and playing for many, many years.
You had mentioned the sort of reluctance, even in higher education, to engage around issues of race, equity, inclusion, diversity in the classroom and research. And I wondered about institutional change. Is that driven from the institutional level, or is it more often driven from the students? And as I was reflecting on the weekend residency experience of the student kind of laying out and saying, "Hey, this is how I'm feeling. Let's talk about these things." And then you kind of picking up on the feeling in the classroom and already having it on your mind, this sort of intersection of these two forces. I wonder how you see that playing out in higher education as a catalyst for change, or how change actually gets made.
Students are key stakeholders. Young people have been leading the current protest movement in the same way that young people played a critical role in protest movements, even in the 1960s. We talk about Martin Luther King Jr. as if he's an elder, because he would be in his 90s now, but he was assassinated when he was 38. He was leading the Montgomery bus boycott when he was 26 years old. So that the energy and the fire and the passion that comes from young people has been unparalleled in catalyzing transformational change. And we've seen so much of that on college campuses as well. There were four college students from North Carolina A&T who sat at a Woolworths counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, your home state, Brett, right?
That is right.
And they the Freedom Riders were students. They were college students who were riding these buses throughout the country to put on full display the harm and the violence that comes along with racism. This is not just a subtle Jim Crow arrangement of, you all stay over there and play, we'll stay over here and play, but that there was a violent resistance toward integration and students, so many young people were brave enough to put their lives on the line to make the case for justice globally. And we also saw them doing that on college campuses. There were protests. We talked a lot in our research at Harvard Business School about the founding of the African American Student Union at Harvard Business School. Well, the founding of ASU at Harvard Business School came when a group of students, African American students, were very few in numbers. And inspired by a lot of the protests, but also motivated, I would say invigorated, not motivated, but invigorated, and maybe in slightly incensed in some, in some accounts, by the fact that they showed up at HBS on the day after Martin Luther King had been assassinated, and class went on as usual, and nobody said anything about it. And they went to the dean and said, "Look, you can do better, you must do better." And that felt very risky for them. Five black students out of, several hundred at that time coming and making that case to call the administration to more consciousness. And through that, faculty became more diverse while the student body also became more diverse. So, in my leading change courses, I always include a segment on grassroots initiatives and leading change. And I talk about Martin Luther King Jr., the Montgomery bus boycott, but also talking about the March on Washington for workers' rights. That was a core element. It was not just about integrating retail operations and buses. But, you know, when King was assassinated in Memphis, he was advocating for the rights of sanitation workers, Black sanitation workers in Memphis. So all of that to say, the changes that we've seen in our institutions, be it higher ed, be it the workplace, have often been in response to an external call to consciousness. That contrasts with our leadership portrayal of change, which is the leader has this vision that sort of descends upon him because him, right? Because he's so sage and has such foresight that he is able to develop this vision, and then he has the charisma that can move the whole firm in accordance with that vision. And in moments like this, we're reminded that institutional change is as much a function of the senior leader's vision as it is the key stakeholders who have much less formal and institutional power, but have that moral conviction and compass to move the organization in a different direction.
I'm thinking a lot as you're talking through this about the role that students in the sort of grassroots element play in sort of advocating for change and sort of pushing organizational consciousness. I'm thinking a lot about our incoming students. I'm thinking about prospective students. We've seen, certainly in the wake of recent events, we've seen interest and energy from these populations of engaging around these topics. What advice would you have for students who are saying, look, you know, I'm coming to Darden in August, or, you know, I'm planning on starting my MBA program. I want to make sure that these conversations happen as part of my program experience. What advice would you have for those students?
My advice is to hold on to that interest, hold on to that concern. Don't come in and assume or accept that just because you don't hear it within your cohort or in your learning team or in this particular course or that particular course that it's not relevant or it's not acceptable or it's not a valuable path of learning for the community. Hold fast to your personal commitment to integrate those elements of the lived experience into the formal curriculum of what you're learning and taking in at Darden. And so don't be afraid to speak up about that. There are a lot of open ears right now, and I believe open hearts too. And the time is ripe. But the truth is we have to find new ways. We have to develop new practices and new routines to be more effective in promoting the inclusion and justice that we're seeking, because the templates that we've been utilizing in years past, they just simply aren't working. The data are showing that. We're looking at representation, we're looking at police brutality, we're looking at a justice system that is not supporting or protecting the rights of people who are being disproportionately subject to violence. We're looking at a pandemic that disproportionately targeted Black and brown communities in droves, you know? And so the programs and the systems that we have put in place and that may seem so comfortable and familiar, they aren't working in helping us to transform society so that it aligns with our ideals. So we really need that creative energy. We need that voice. Don't assume that people have the solutions or the answers and they're just not doing it. Lots of times people really don't know what or how to do things in ways that will meet the needs that are being expressed. And so we've got to come together in collaboration, you know, critical consciousness, yes, but also collaboration to find new ways to partner together and lead changed.
Well, Laura, I want to thank you so much for your time today. It was a pleasure. I would love to have had this conversation for another 3 or 4 hours, but in the interest of your schedule and and everything. It's been a pleasure catching up with you. I look forward to seeing you again in person, hopefully soon, one of these days back around Sam's Family Grounds.
Exactly. That's the good news. We know where to find each other. But thanks for the opportunity to dialogue, Brett.
Absolutely. And that was my interview with Laura Morgan Roberts, a professor here at the Darden School of Business. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at Darden, that's D-A-R-D-E-N, at virginia.edu. And until next time, be safe, stay well, and thanks for listening.